American Log Homes and Cabins is assisting a developer in liquidating several of our kits that have deposits on them for only the balance owed. Most of these will save you more than half of the original cost. An example, our Augusta model, normally $42,450, is being sold for $16,500. Our Biloxi model, normally $36,825, is being sold for $14,500. This includes delivery, excluding California, Oregon, Washington, Arizona, Idaho, Alaska, and Hawaii, but we will pay partial shipping to those states. These kits have not been manufactured, and there's no time limit on delivery. This is a log home kit that includes complete blueprints from foundation details to roof, stack sheets, and a construction manual. Any do-it-yourselfer or builder can erect the logs. Kits do not include any part of roof, windows, or doors. Please call 704-602-3035 for availability. You can also visit our website at www.AmericanLogHomesAndCabins.com.
Movies and Booze, I'm Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.
Vanola Jones, Chris Wasser, and Dean McGuinness join us once again for Movies and Booze. Good afternoon to you all.
Hello, hi guys.
Tell us about the beer, Dean.
Where?
And Hush Money. Describe the design of the beer in non-defamatory terms.
It has a random felon who has been convicted of some random crime.
Yes, indeed.
In an orange jumpsuit with a distinctive blonde quiff. And a large
orange face, which is blocked out, so we can't identify this.
It is for confidentiality. And I would say
it looks like Kamala Harris. If it was Joe Biden looking at it, he might think it was Kamala Harris.
they're having some great fun. Well, a lot of the time, I look at all of the other styles, and it drives me mental when I bump into somebody and I say, I'm in craft beer, and they say, oh, IPAs. And I'm like, no, craft beer, you know. And there is a kind of a thing that craft beer is IPA is craft beer. So I find that I almost avoid IPAs, so I figured I'd better not avoid IPAs
all right.
The time. So we're doing two IPAs from Irish breweries. The first one is called Hush Money, and it has a distinctively overweight presidential type figure in an orange jumpsuit in a jail cell on the can of it. And the second one is called Flora and Fauna from Western Herd. And we're looking at the American influence on Irish brewery. People talk about whether we look towards Berlin or Boston. And there's a distinct and slightly ironic thing that we do tend to look towards America. But in so doing, we've adopted a style that was originally English, which is usually not something that we go for in Ireland. I had my kids watching the England match, and true to form for every Irish football fan in the country, they were hoping that England would lose.
Really? Shock me. Are you saying that like the brewing style is influenced by what Americans are doing now, that they in turn have originally got that from England anyway.
The Americans would have adopted the India Pale Ale style. It would have originated in England. The first one was done by a guy called George Hodgson in the Bow Brewery, and that would have been the beer that would have been brewed as a quite a strong, quite hoppy pale ale, and was popular in the UK, but also shipped to the Indian colonies. And the Americans looked for distinctive styles, and India Pale Ale was one of the styles that they looked at. And it seems to just have become something that, you know, grew and grew and grew, and has split into many, many, 10 styles now at this stage. And when you're talking about an American IPA versus an English IPA, the American IPA is so called because they're using American hops. And the American hops are quite straightforward in terms of understanding them. They're fruity hops, so you tend to get tropical fruit flavors or citrus flavors like lemon-lime flavors. And they're flavors that tend to make sense in people's minds. When you're looking at English hops, you get earthy flavors and herbal flavors. And that doesn't quite trigger a memory of flavour in your mind. You know, it's a more obscure flavour.
Are these made with Irish hops then?
These are made with American hops.
Okay.
So they're using American hops, Galaxy and two others in this one, Hush Money. And the second one that we'll be doing has 10 different hops in it.
Wow. So you can tell us when we come to talk about Hush Money, but I'm interested to know where you can get it. Does a certain hotel in Doonbeg sell it, for instance, if one were going on a golfing break there? That would be fun to have. Despicable Me 4.
Yeah.
There's been...
Please, because I kind of enjoy the other three, I must say. That,
did you?
You know, yeah.
Right. The first one, maybe.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like, I find those films, because there are six of them now, because there was two Minions films.
Yes, you're right.
And then there's another Minions film coming in 2027, which I think will probably be called Mega Minions, but more on that later. I find those films, it's a little bit like watching a stand-up comic perform the same set over and over and over. I don't know how they keep getting away with it. But look... There's six of them. This is the fourth Despicable Me one. So this is the fourth one with Steve Carell in this. And it's a weird thing. Remember when films used to come out in America so long, or even a week or two before they would come out here? It's a weird one. This had a bit of a staggered release. So it was actually out in America last week and a few other international territories. So by the time it gets here, it's already on about 260, 270 million worldwide. So that's how popular. To give you a comparison, like Furiosa, George Miller's latest Furiosa with Chris Hemsworth, that didn't even make 200 million in its entire run. So the Minions and Steve Carell's, you know, despicable supervillain, they're still very, very popular.
Yeah. Kids love it.
Do they?
They do.
Do they?
Yeah,
no, they do. No, they're obsessed with it.
Yeah.
That's very depressing.
They do. I'm sorry. Children, maybe a lot of the time, aren't that bright. Yeah. You know, only when it comes to getting stuff out of you, they're very fresh. But for stuff like this, because they're kind of cute and familiar, and that kind of forgives a lot.
Yeah.
Your average 8-year-old ain't going, the narrative structure there was a bit ropey. You know?
I don't know. Like, I did wonder if I was being too harsh on it, and if it is, and I haven't even reviewed it yet. But I'm just thinking Inside Out 2, which is still in cinemas.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like that has set the bar extraordinarily high, and that should be where children's animation is at. You know,
so good.
Full of ideas, moving, thoughtful, great voice acting as opposed to just...
You see, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Right? That my 8-year-old daughter and my wife went to see Inside Out 2.
Mm.
I gave my daughter hankies to hand to my wife
when
she inevitably said, I'm not crying, you're crying. Whereas my daughter was like, she's got these things running in her head. Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
It's a lovely film. So, look, we'll get to the review in a bit, but I can't believe these things are still around. The other film is Long Legs, which I was kind of even asking going into it, is this going to be the scariest film of 2024? And the reason I asked that is because everyone on the marketing team kept telling me, that, you know, when you watch the trailers and you watch the posters, it's like, this is the most terrifying movie event of 2024. It's a serial killer feature, you know, somewhere in the vein of Seven, Zodiac, Silence of the Lambs, Michael Monroe's in it, but an awful lot of the attention is on the fact that Nicolas Cage is playing this serial killer that is hidden away from the audience for the first hour. And you know that Nicolas Cage is not very good at hiding.
Yes.
You can hear
him shouting off camera. Yeah.
If Nicolas Cage is in something, he's going to let you know that he's in something. Going into it, there were high expectations, and I'll let you know in a bit if it met those expectations.
Yeah. Where are we with Nicolas Cage now? Is he, because he was kind of a joke figure for a while, and then he became kind of... some weirdly beloved.
Yeah, the best thing he ever did was embrace his weirdness and embrace the fact that people expected him to be silly and over the top and to, you know, do his, what he calls his nouveau shamanic style acting, which is just, I don't know. I don't know what it is.
Is that what he calls it?
Yeah, it's about, you know, being in the moment and improvising and kind of just going with whatever, you know, takes him when he's performing and whatever he's in. I'll tell you where Nicolas Cage is at the moment. He's in a good place financially because he's finally paid off all his taxes.
And okay, good.
The fact that you know, he had so many debts there and he was in so much trouble with property and unpaid taxes and a dodgy business manager, that has all been resolved. But because he got used to making so many B movies and saying yes to everything all the time, he eventually found his way to all these talented B movie directors. So Nicolas Cage has kind of become a franchise into himself at this point. That, you know, there are an awful lot of, you know, this is not really a B movie, but there are an awful lot of creepy, chilling horror films starring Nicolas Cage at the minute. And that's not a bad thing. He's made a few good ones. Mandy, do you remember Mandy?
Yeah.
That was quite good. Pig, not really a horror film, but it was still very good. Arcadian, which was shot in Ireland. There's some good stuff out there at the minute with Nick Cage in it.
Yeah. But will Nick Cage ever be able to, you know, work his way back towards, I don't know, a family drama or something where people act reasonably normally.
I don't even think he wants to do that. I think we're actually going to see him after this playing, do you remember he was Noir Spider-Man in the animated Spider-Man? He's actually doing a live action version of that. So Nick Cage is at a point where he's, you know, playing dress up from now on. And he's going to be wildly over the top. He's going to be taking on all of these inventive roles. I don't think we're going to see him as, you know, divorced dad trying to win back his 13-year-old daughter in an award-winning family drama. That's not him anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Someone said, Pete says, the Western Herd beers are absolutely lovely. Their Blue Jumper IPA is worth a taste. Up the banner. Yeah. And somebody, a question for you, Chris. Why are minions shaped like suppositories?
I get asked this all the time.
There may be a kind of an R-rated version. Just, Nick Cage will probably be in it. You know, minions hanging out of his butt. That's, I pay cash money to see that.
I would produce that film.
Yes.
Yeah.
That would be great. Right, The Devil Wears Prada 2. When's that coming out?
We don't have a date yet, but it's a lot of the original cast coming back and the original directors. That's David Frankel. Apparently Meryl Streep is on board. Emily Blunt is on board. There was, just in case people don't know this, so The Devil Wears Prada was based on a book and there is a sequel to that book.
Ah, right.
But the sequel that is underway at Disney, it doesn't seem to be following that same plot line. So basically, like, spoilers for The Devil Wears Prada 2 book, essentially, like, Andy, who's played by Anne Hathaway, she ends up setting up a magazine, a rival magazine with Emily, but it's like a bridal magazine and her life is all sorted and she's met the love of her life, blah, blah, blah. But of course, all is not what it seems. Shocker. And she ends up having to go back to Miranda Priestley and, you know, more devilish behaviour ensues, right?
Right.
But this sequel seems to be that it's like, I don't think Anne Hathaway is involved. She doesn't seem to have signed up from what I've read so far. But it seems to be that it's Miranda Priestley, who's played by Meryl Streep, going up against Emily Blunt's character, Emily Charlton. Emily is now like a high power executive who works for like a luxury brand, and she makes decisions over where to place like advertising contracts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's basically about like the decline of print media, to which I say, does anyone want that film? Like, when this came out, everyone was like, yes, Devil Wears Prada 2, oh my God, Meryl Streep is back, I'm so excited. If we're to boil this down to the reality of what it is, like, we're living in nostalgia land there where we're like, we want this back. We don't like. I do find the premise of exploring the decline of print media and how everything is up to the brands now and where that money goes, like, that's interesting. I find that interesting because I work in media. Like, I don't know if anyone else would find that interesting, and I don't know how you stretch that out over a film. As a TV series, I'm kind of like, maybe, but even then I'm just like, you're kind of going away from what made the first one good, which was the whole thing of like, Andy wasn't into fashion and then got into fashion and those kind of dynamics. You know what I mean?
It was kind of Sex in the City energy, really, the first movie, which this doesn't sound like that at all.
No, like, it sounds like, you know, Meryl Streep, she navigates the decline of the traditional print publication in the digital space. Boring.
But also, like, for, like, the fashion industry, which not that many people would have a huge amount of sympathy for.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't buy $1,000 shoes anymore.
What a nightmare. The landscape is too different. And then also it's like, okay, there is part of me that is intrigued about Meryl Streep coming back to this particular role, but like the fact that Anne Hathaway is like, bye, have fun. Like, that's why they've changed the plot as well, I would imagine, because she's not going anywhere near this.
Well, is it also because Anne Hathaway has Anne Hathaway moved a bit beyond the kind of wide-eyed ingenue kind of thing she had going on for a while?
No, absolutely not. Have you seen The Idea of You?
No.
Oh, incredible, incredible piece of filmmaking, I will say, on Prime Video, in which this older, quote-unquote older woman gets with Harry Styles-esque and the daughter listens to...
Well, I thought it was like a, you know, sex scene and you know, she, Anne Hathaway wants to change her image a bit.
She wants to be given it loads, like, maybe.
Yeah, bring in the raunch.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, so that's not the character she played.
Again, print media, that sexy?
Mm. Isn't The Idea of You terrible?
No. Yes. Chris is saying
yes. No. She's brilliant in it. She is fantastic.
The cast is so good. It's her and Nicholas Galitzine.
Yeah.
It's so stupid, but like, it's, they bring so much to it. It's crazy. I would recommend.
All right, so
Chris doesn't, but Chris.
Chris, what stupid film do you want to talk about first?
Despicable Me 4.
We aren't supposed to lie.
Don't think of it as lying. Think of it as high stakes pretending.
Well, I'm not going to.
Ah, just a little white lie.
Nope.
Agnes, As your father, I command you to lie.
No.
Yes, lie.
Mm-mm.
You are walking on thin ice, little lady. Why can't you be more like your sister, Edith? She lies all the time.
No, I don't.
See? See? She's lying right now. Beautifully, I might add.
There you go. That's a Despicable Me 4, where the world's favourite suppository is getting up to all sorts of madcap adventures. So what's the premise here?
I don't really know. It's overcrowded. There's so much going on in it. But I suppose the central story is we have Gru, reformed supervillain, anti-villain league. He's at his high school reunion. He went to this villain school, which looks a little bit like Transylvania. You know, Dracula's castle in Transylvania. And he's having a great time with all the other bad dudes. And one of them crashes the party, and his name is Maxime. It turns out he's an old nemesis of Gru. He's voiced by Will Ferrell, which is interesting because Will Ferrell had his own supervillain series. Remember Megamind?
Yes. Yeah.
So you've forgotten all about that. So yeah, they all exist in the same universe, maybe. But it turns out this guy, Maxime, has spent years working on this cockroach gun that's turned himself into a cockroach. And for reasons that are never really explained, he thinks he can take over the world as half man, half cockroach.
Okay.
And he also plans to kidnap and turn Gru's little baby boy into a cockroach. He's captured, he gets out of prison, he's captured again. Turns out this guy is too much of a threat, so the powers that be step in and they put Gru and his family in a safe house and give them new identities. I will admit, that idea of giving this, you know, reformed supervillain who's still trying to figure out how to be a good guy, place him in a town where nobody really knows him and try and just get him to be an ordinary guy, that's a great idea.
Okay,
just,
yes.
Like, embrace that, go with that. Unfortunately, the film just keeps distracting itself. It's so strange. It gets all caught up in this plot about this subplot about this aspiring teenage baddie who wants to go to the school that Gru used to go to. There's a huge subplot in there about how five of the minions are plucked by the anti-villain league to be mega minions. They're kind of turned into these little, it's like a Fantastic Four, except there's five of them. So that's clearly setting up the next Minions film. It keeps getting distracted by things like Maxime's background, this Will Ferrell's character and his school days, Gru picking up tennis. There's too many, the kids going to karate lessons. There's far too much in here. And it becomes less about, as it goes along, it becomes less about like storytelling and structure. And I know these are weird things to say about, you know, a film with those cartoon banana bugs in them. Nobody really goes to the Minions for, you know, storytelling, structure and all the rest of it. But it's just all about how much noise and how much chaos can we cram into a single scene? And also, how many pop songs can we get into a film in 10 minutes? So the film just kind of ends up resembling a trailer for itself. And you need to take a break from it. It's just too much. It's too much gobbledygook. It's too much nonsense, too much chaos. And it's one thing to have that voice cast. You've a great cast in there. Will Ferrell, Steve Carell, Joey King, Kristen Wiig, Sofia Vergara, Pierre Coffin, who's obviously the guy who does the Minions. Great cast, given nothing to do. If you're going to have, it's one thing to have funny voices, you need to give them funny lines. And also, I will say, there's one hugely mismanaged and misjudged joke, which is that this cockroach fella, instead of minions, he has a little army of cute, in inverted commas, cockroaches working for him. So these teeny tiny dancing singing little cockroaches, the filmmakers have gotten something very wrong there. It doesn't matter what you do, you can put them in hats, you can put them in silly outfits, you can give them canes, you can have them tell the funniest joke in the world. They don't. Cockroaches are not cute.
They're
terrifying. They're the worst thing in the world. The only thing they're good for is surviving the apocalypse. They are not good for a kid's cartoon. So there's far too much going on in it. I did not like this, Sean.
I'd like to hear from any listeners who do find cockroaches cute. It sounds like a series of set pieces rather you know, oh yeah, we'll get back to the plot now in a while.
Yeah, a little bit like that. If Despicable Me 4 was a TV, it feels as though it was an idea for a Saturday morning series or something. You had maybe like five or six installments. And this week, we're going to look at this new supervillain, Maxime. And then next week, we're going to look at, you know, the kids trying to live a normal life despite the fact their dad's a supervillain. None of it is coherent. It doesn't really hold itself together very well. And as I said, there's a lovely cast there, but you've got like Sofia Vergara, who just says things like Maxime, or oh, they're gonna get it now, or oh, I can't wait to take over the world. Like, how much were these guys paid to say these very ordinary throwaway lines? It is quite sad. And the reason I'm probably being so hard on it is because the bar has been set so extraordinarily high by DreamWorks. That last was it the Bad Guys, and also the last Puss in Boots film, the animation was just the last Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle film too, animation was just superb, popped off the screen, the jokes were brilliant, the story was lovely. Then you've got Inside Out 2, which is just breaking box office records left, right and centre at the minute. Again, so many good ideas in there and so many great performances, and just the animation is just next level. When the bar is that high, you need to do better.
Yeah.
You need
yeah.
to.
Yeah, that is a shame. Yeah. Anyway, speaking about supervillains, let's move on to our first beer of the day, Dean.
Well, the first beer, Hush Money from Third Barrel Brewing. Now, looking at the American influence on Irish craft brewing. So what you have here, it's a 5.9% IPA. So it's the accepted range in the guidelines for an IPA would be 5.5 to 7.5%. And when you come below the 5.5%, it would be heading into a session IPA territory. And okay. going above 7.5%, you're going up into double IPA, which is what the second beer that we're tasting is. Now, brewed with American hops, and with American hops, particularly in later years, what has become really popular with American IPAs are real tropical fruit flavors. So pineapple, mango, melon type flavors. And then as well as that, you've got a certain amount of stone fruit flavor coming through. Absolutely, it's a tricky thing with a beer like this, where they've like the label is absolutely superb. And when you've got a beer with a label like that, the danger is that people think that it's just a novelty beer because
yes,
of the label.
Yeah.
What they've done a very good job is if they've done a superb beer and then put a superb label onto it as well. So absolutely a great job. Now, the guys in Third Barrel, they come from home brewing. And that is where craft brewing started in the US. People like Sam Caglione, who set up Dogfish Head, and the guys behind Bell's Brewery in Michigan, they were home brewers who were frustrated because they couldn't get the beers that they wanted. So they started trying to build up the infrastructure for them to be able to brew their own beer. And then that became commercial and built up from that in the 80s. With this, you have two guys who were home brewers. One was brewing beers under the brand Third Circle, and the other one was brewing beers under the brand Stone Barrel, and they came together and got a brewery between them and now work together on Third Barrel beers. It was all one-off beers, limited release seasonal beers, all really interesting stuff. They've done a really good job with their beers. They've got very popular, and now they're starting to do core beers. Usually it works in reverse. People do a core beer and then they do the fun stuff around it. These guys really started out on the kind of creative, innovative side and have done a classic example of an American IPA, but have done it very, very well and then had great fun with the label as well.
Yeah, so but is it a limited edition beer? I only ask this for it. Will it be out of circulation by, say, November, December, before somebody gets elected and starts aiming their nukes at this country?
Yeah, I was, as I was writing the notes, about now, I think, is when he was meant to be sentenced, but it's been delayed till September. Yes. I expect that it will be available if you want to drink it in September as the sentencing happens. So it's a kind of an interesting thing that's happening on
okay.
the other side.
It is a lovely IPA, though. It must
They've
be said,
done a superb
yeah.
job.
It is a lovely IPA. Now, more film. You see, what we call film news now is just, you know, sequel of the week, really, isn't it?
You could do this section on ChatGPT at this point, but the robots can't drink wine, so don't replace me, please.
Shrek 5!
Woohoo! This is exactly what we wanted, coming 2026, so we have a while to wait. Eddie Murphy had talked about this a couple of months ago, and I don't think he was meant to say it. He was in an interview saying that he was doing the voiceover work for this, but this is officially confirmed. So we're going to get July 1st, 2026. Mike Myers is back as Shrek. Obviously, Eddie Murphy, I just said. Cameron Diaz, all confirmed to return. Antonio Banderas as Puss in Boots. So yeah, no ideas around plot or anything like that. Who knows where they could go? But it seems like it's all the original team. I mean, as we've already talked about, like the Puss in Boots films made a lot of money. The Shrek films made a lot of money. Like, it makes sense from that perspective. This is going to make absolute bank when it comes back. Like, because you're banking on the people who loved the original films going, which they will, and then you're bringing kids who have no idea about Shrek. You know what I mean? Because the first one was out in, what was it, 2000, 2001?
Mm.
You know? So,
jeez, 20 years. Yeah, more than 20 years. But if he's been doing voice work, would they not have, like, drawn the pictures already? To use a technical term, listeners might understand.
Yeah, actually, again, I don't really understand animation, so I'm not really sure what the delay is for. But I will say also that there is, like, a spin-off Donkey movie coming then as well, which I think will be coming after this Shrek. It never ends. It will never end. I will be 800 years old sitting in this chair telling you about Shrek 45. It's going to be great.
It
can't wait.
Back to the swamp. Sticking out of
Minions
his backside.
67. Woohoo.
The backlash has started, Chris. The Despicable Minions are the best set of kids' movies.
Okay.
Someone else says, I will review Despicable Me 4 tonight after I see it. That film critic has no soul.
Oh, soul.
Wow.
No soul.
Wow.
Listen, it's not
you and Nicolas Cage. Yeah. Darkness personified. Yeah.
It's not the worst thing anyone said.
And Lena Dunham is no longer doing the Polly Pocket movie.
Yes, I had talked a couple weeks ago. What a sentence.
I think that's a relief. I think it's probably the wise choice.
Yeah. Now, I will say she was only on board as a writer, and I think she is a good writer. Say what you want about her. I do think she's a good writer, but she's essentially said, she gave this very long quote to the New Yorker about why she's like not doing it. And it was essentially that she felt like she couldn't do something that would live up to what Barbie had done and like what Greta Gerwig did with Barbie, how original and distinct that was, which kind of leads me to, I don't know. I think she'd done like had three goes at the script or whatever. So who knows where this is going to go. And that is the difficulty with any of these follow-up Mattel films, which there are going to be loads of, as I've talked about previously on this show. Like you, whatever comes next lives in the shadow of Barbie. And it's never, and you know, like the other brands like Polly Pocket obviously isn't as big of a brand as Barbie, but like I think you've less room to play with because of that. Do you know what I mean? Like it was the, you know, it was supposed to be like, you know, a young girl and a pocket-sized woman who form a friendship. Okay, again, we've kind of seen variations of that before. You know what I mean? So I don't know.
That's all they've got. Like that's all they're giving to the writers.
Well, like Lily Collins is, well, actually, I'm not sure if she's attached to Star, but I'm not sure if she's the woman or the pocket-sized woman. And she's producing, but beyond that, we've no idea. And there's no news on whoever's taken over the script. But wouldn't say it's looking good for the Polly Pocket movie. But
Dear. Yeah. Someone says, a year on, what did we really think of Barbie? Loved it at the time. Saw it at a flight recently. Was kind of meh.
I actually haven't seen it since I watched it. I'm not, so I don't think it'd be fair for me to say, but
yeah, I wasn't crazy about the film when it came out, but I thought she was terrific in it. I thought Gosling was super. It is very clever. It is funny. I think at the time I remember thinking, especially when Will Ferrell was involved, it was like an SNL sketch that got out of hand. But there are some really good ideas and good things. And also, Barbie wasn't a success because it was a film about toys. And I hate the fact that like so many studios now are kind of like, oh, what else is in the Mattel bank or you know box that we can make, or let's have a Polly Pocket film, let's have a Monopoly film, whatever it is. That's not why it was absolutely.
Does anyone think that the new Gladiator movie trailer just looks like a copy of the original and may turn out to be a major turkey and be ruinous to Paul Mescal's career?
Yeah, it's a little bit messy, that trailer.
Ooh.
Like, it's big, it's epic, it's everything I suppose
isn't
you want
like,
to be.
Isn't he like a punch it out with a rhino or something?
He does have a punch out with a rhino, yeah. And it is very impressive. It looks like he beheads someone at some stage too. I am excited to see it. I do think, you know, parts of it will work, but I got more of an Alexander vibe off that trailer than I did a Gladiator vibe.
Oh dear.
No. Don't say that.
I know. I want it to work out for him. I really do. You know, and it's Ridley Scott. Every time I go see a new Ridley Scott film, I forget about the last one. It's like, I'm excited about this. Let me down before.
That's one for the trailer. You'll forget about the last one. What did you think of the trailer?
I thought it was good. But I think there's a bigger conversation to be had around.
You're raving
like,
there.
Yeah, though. Well, I think there's a bigger conversation to be had around like trailer culture and the fact that everything is given away now in trailers.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't think it's going to be a total turkey. I think it's going to be like good to maybe great. I don't know. I don't think it's going to be a flop. Like, I think it's going to make loads of money. Paul is a good actor.
Yeah.
Fundamentally. So is Pedro Pascal. I don't know. I'm like quietly confident.
But the thing is, if it costs, it's rumored to have cost $310 million. Mm. So in order to make a profit, it needs to make at least $600 million. I don't see that happening.
Yeah. Ridley has lost it. Do we all remember Napoleon?
That's what he wants us to forget. That's why.
Yeah. Napoleon worked, actually.
Did it?
Ish. I'm starting to doubt myself.
Very ish. Very ish. 18 says, a good swap for Devil Wears Prada 2 would be Anne Hathaway's character staging a takeover of the magazine from Meryl Streep's character. Come on, people, write a good predictable script like the good old days.
Exactly.
Yeah, except Anne Hathaway isn't going to be in it.
No.
So.
Maybe money talks, as we've said many times on this show.
Yeah.
So.
I don't like the concept. Here's another million. I like the concept. It's as simple as that. Right, let's get on to our second beer of the day, Dee.
Right, we're on to our second beer, Flora and Fauna from Western Herd. Western Herd is down in Lahinch, County Clare. And a direct American influence here, we have a brewer called Bridger Keller, who is from Montana. When I was first chatting to him, I had to be cautious because I hadn't known this before, but the accent in Montana is quite similar to the Canadian accent. And
okay.
When you're listening, there's certain words that you can pick up. Oot is one.
Oot, yeah.
That thing. So when I was listening to him, I was thinking, are you Canadian or American? But American from Montana. Now, the other notable thing about craft beer and how it developed in the US was it started out with people looking to do beer with a bit more flavor. And a bit more flavor was beer with maybe 30, 40 IBUs, which was quite high relative to 8 IBUs or bitterness units for Budweiser. So when you taste Budweiser, there's virtually no bitterness. There's virtually no flavor in it. But if you were to be able to discern...
Then you have no taste units?
negative bitterness units. If you were to be able to discern the bitterness in Budweiser, it would be 8 bitterness units. And they were bringing it up to about kind of 4 or 5 times that. Or maybe about double the bitterness in something like Carlsberg or Heineken. And that was a good step, but they continued to do that and bring it further and further and further. So Dogfish Head, one of the breweries that I mentioned, they brought out a 60-minute IPA, which was literally called 60-minute IPA because they put a handful of hops into the kettle every minute over the course of 60 minutes.
Whoa. Okay.
And then they decided, yeah, that worked, so let's do a 90-minute IPA.
Yeah.
And then, of course, a 120-minute IPA was just absolutely necessary to do. So you have a number of breweries that just went really extreme in terms of what they were doing, and they pushed it in terms of styles and pushed it in terms of range of what the beers are. So this is a beer of that ilk, if you like. It's using 10 different hops: Columbus, Simcoe, El Dorado, Citra, Centennial, Amarillo, Cascade and Chinook in the kettle, and then they're dry hopping, which is hops that are added after fermentation with Nelson Sauvin and Strata. It's a double IPA, so a bit above average in strength. They have interestingly put the ABV down as 9.45%, which is particularly accurate. I don't know if there's a,
wow.
a reason why they're putting it at 9.45 as opposed to 9.4 or 9.5. But I suppose if you were drinking 9.5% beer, that would just be out of order.
Maybe that makes it sound more believable.
Yes.
we measured it so precisely.
But So again, the name Flora and Fauna, the flora is the hops. I don't know whether the intention on the fauna is that it's a meaty beer. This is a big, rich beer.
Yes, it is.
It's got a lot of flavour in it. The malt character is coming through, but really good hop characters. There's a kind of a biscuity malt character coming through, and then stone fruit and berries coming through. There's a richness to it. The alcohol carries through and builds up the flavour. But again, of the ilk, of the... kind of more extreme beers that you would have got as craft brewing was developing in the States.
It doesn't taste like it's 9.45% or whatever it is.
Bridger's done a great job on getting the balance right in the beer. And when you get that balance right, you get kind of individual flavours. And what you want is for one not to kind of overpower the others. So there is an amount of alcohol warming, and alcohol gives flavours of bitterness and sweetness as well as that warming character. And that contributes and develops the flavour in the beer as well. The Blue Jumper beer that the listener mentioned when he texted in, that's a reference to Father Ted. They're down in County Clare.
Huh.
And it's the, the episode where he's kind of trying to remember what happened.
You wear your blue jumper. Excellent. Flora is the best beer made in Ireland, in my opinion. Amazing layers and complexity. Dan says, can you ask your booze reviewer, the last time I had an IPA, I had the best sex of my life. I'm afraid to drink them again in case it doesn't live up to expectation. Does he think it will?
Sounds almost propositional.
That's almost impossible to answer, really. Somebody else just texted in, opinion of Bad Boys movie. I don't know if this is like the title for a subsequent text they're going to send in to tell us their opinion, or if they're asking what your opinion is. There's no grammar or no question marks involved, so we don't know what you mean. Was it good?
No.
There you go.
Of course it wasn't good.
Text back, no. Just exactly like that. Right, we'll move on to our, Andrea, Anne Hathaway's friends, including her miserable boyfriend in Devil Wears Prada, were the most sanctimonious, judging, horrible people. Every time I watch it, I want her to shove his birthday cake where the sun don't shine and tell all our friends to mind their own feckin' business, says Deirdre. The wounds are still raw for Deirdre from that movie.
As I said off air, he's the villain. The boyfriend's the villain, not Miranda Priestley.
Yeah. Yeah.
Watch The Devil Wears Prada again. He's the villain.
Yeah, right. I'll move on to our second movie of the day. It is Long Legs. Here's a clip.
Will you tell me the honest truth about something? I'll try. Do you still say your prayers? No, Mom. I never said my prayers, never once. They scared me.
Okay, good evil laugh there, at least. As you were saying, we don't see Nicolas Cage for the first hour or so.
Yeah. He's on screen, but the aspect ratio in this film keeps changing. So you have basically like Nicolas Cage's body, and he's quite gangly, and his clothes are filthy, and he kind of moves like he's supposed to be obsessed with glam rock, and he's a huge T-Rex fan. He kind of moves as though he was like a rocker back in the day, but it's just a little bit weird now. But his face is always hidden. Like his face is out of shot, or he has his hands over his face. And it is, and it sounds sort of silly, but it's actually... it's quite unsettling. It does what it's supposed to. Plot-wise, you heard Lee Harker there, played by Michael Monroe. She is a rookie with the FBI in the 1990s at a time in rural Oregon where this serial killer who calls himself Long Legs is just causing all sorts of grisly mayhem. And Long Legs has the feds completely stumped. He leaves no trace at his crime scenes. It also looks as though his crimes aren't really his, because there's a series of family murder-suicides where all of the crimes seem to be perpetrated by a violent father who appears to have lost his mind. And the way in which some of the people are killed are quite similar. The fact that the child in every family in these areas, like there's always a child who was born on the 14th date of each month. So the feds are like, what's this guy? Is this guy, you know, following some sort of satanic ritual? What's going on here? And there's always a letter from a person called Long Legs and a cryptic code obviously someone, you know, there's obviously going to be some rookie investigator, that's Lee Harker, comes along and says, I know how to solve this code. She also seems to have some sort of vaguely psychic ability where she's able to kind of tell what house or what area the killer is going to track next. She can't actually go as far as finding the killer because the film would just be over in 5 minutes.
Yeah, sure.
But she has this, like, you know, some cops have a hunch, you know, she has this ability where she can tell if, you know, Long Legs is watching her, and he is watching her, because one night she goes home and there's a letter from Long Legs addressed to her, and he starts kind of leaving clues all around Oregon that, you know, lets the feds know, You might be looking for me, but I'm actually watching you. I know where you are. So things start to take on a bit of a spectacularly unsettling turn when the two of them kind of get a little bit closer. So it's a nice little cat and mouse game. And for the first hour, it's every bit as good as the films it's borrowing from, because there are shades of Zodiac in there. There are shades of Silence of the Lambs, Michael Monroe in the Jodie Foster role. And it did everything, as I said, it was supposed to. It got right under my skin. I have been thinking about it since I watched it. It's not full on frightening, but it's just very disturbing. And there's no cheap jump scares here. Visually, like, you know, there's kind of like teases of nightmare scenarios, and you see a little bit of violence here and there, but there's just enough. It's kind of one of those clever horror films that makes you think afterwards, oh, I saw too much.
I feel a butt coming here.
Yeah, there is a huge butt coming.
Is it
up.
A big butt?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I like big butts. I
should say as well, Osgood Perkins made this, the son of Anthony Perkins from Psycho.
Oh, right, yeah. Okay.
He acquits himself very well as a director. As a writer, I'm still not that convinced. Vince, because the third act of this film, for some reason, he just lifts the curtain, Perkins that is, and shows his Long Legs in all of his glory. And there's 40 minutes left to go, and he shows us the boogeyman. And as soon as he shows us this villain, he can't stop showing him. And it just strips away all of that mystery and intrigue. And also, it starts leaning very heavily into very silly supernatural fare. And it just spoils what was a very ground, though not entirely grounded, but, you know, not too far-fetched either. There are some weirdos in the world. It just spoils what was such a spectacular build-up. And the more it explains itself, a lot of horror films are doing this at the minute. They overextend themselves and they overexplain themselves. Don't explain the boogeyman too much. I keep saying boogeyman, but don't explain the monster
too
much.
No, yes.
It just ruins everything. So there were parts of this third act where I thought, what? It's just... it's a defeat snatched from the jaws of victory. It really is, like, because that hour is as good as anything I've seen. That first hour is as good as anything I've seen this year. Just couldn't get on board with the third act. But I will say, great performances. Michael Monroe is very good as the detective. Nick Cage, he really did creep me out. There's a brilliant scene in this film where there's a kid who clearly knows that someone's outside stalking the house, and she's going around looking everywhere in the snow. And rather than just give us a jump scare, Perkins shows us the killer creeping out from behind the house in the very far background. Like, and all you hear is him saying, peekaboo. And I was sitting there going, no, gone, out of here.
Yeah.
And that's unsettling. That's effective horror. Yeah. But just the third act spoils it a little bit. So, yeah, it was a 5-star film for a while. It ends as a 3-star.
That's a shame. Now, F1, is this actually not a remake of anything? Is it an actual original movie?
It's an actual original movie about a sport that I am not hugely into, but I know people have gotten very on board with the Netflix series or whatever. So I think people are, maybe I don't want to say excited, but like at the very least intrigued, right? So this is F1. It stars Brad Pitt. He plays Sonny Hayes. He says this former F1 driver returns to the sport and starts mentoring this rookie called Joshua Pierce, who's going to be played by Damson Idris, on APXGP, a fictional 11th team on the grid. That will mean something to people who like F1. That means nothing to me. But Simone Ashley has just joined the cast. We're not really sure what her role is, but she's been popping up at at the Silverstone circuit, and she's been seen at kind of other events on the grid and stuff. So I think people were kind of put two and two together before this official news came out. We got a teaser of it this past weekend, which I think came in conjunction with that race that Lewis Hamilton just won. Lewis Hamilton is actually a co-producer on this film. It's coming June 27, 2025. And it's actually, I was not interested until I heard that it's Joseph Kosinski is directing, who did our fave in here, Top Gun Maverick.
Of course. And Kerry Condon's in it.
Sorry, I forgot to mention that. Our own Kerry Condon. We have Javier Bardem, Tobias Menzies, Sarah Niles and Samson Keo as well, rounding out the cast.
Okay, but it's just a little bit of cars going brum, brum.
Yeah.
I assume.
Yeah.
You know, you probably wouldn't understand that. That's a technical.
Yes.
F1 fans. We say that kind of thing a lot. Fionnuala, Christine, thank you all very much.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.